It was a huge pleasure this week to interview Jeremy Caret, who is the Dean for Europe and Professor of Philosophy, Religion and Culture at the University of Kent. And it's exactly 15 years to the week since Jeremy and I both started working at the University of Kent. We learn how Jeremy came to Canterbury because of love and why he had to demote himself in order to work at the University of Kent, and what happened when, on the Eurostar one day, he found himself sitting next to Jarvis Cocker. Jeremy talks about how the two of us created a new era for religious studies at Kent and broke up some of the old habits and the process involving the renewal of the Michael Ramsey Chair. We talk about the difference between teaching 18 to 21-year-olds and what happened when we both found ourselves some years ago teaching trainee priests and the different challenges that now affect us with respect to Europe. Jeremy talks about the importance of seizing opportunities when they arise, the importance of relationship building, how great advances in knowledge have been through partnerships, and how these are vital to students and the economy. Jeremy talks about how he has been influenced by psychoanalysis. His father was a canon in the Church of England, as well as a therapist, and Jeremy talks about being influenced by R.D. Lang and the impact that the death of his parents had upon him. He talks not just about his own past, but the role of generational and collective pasts and how the past needs to be engaged with by way of a critical reflexivity. Jeremy asks me why I focus on nostalgia, and we talk about how we fabricate the past through contemporary emotional perspectives. Jeremy tells us why it is memory rather than nostalgia which is most important, and why forgetting can be as important as remembering. Jeremy talks about how he used to listen to choral music, wild jazz, Bill Haley and the Beatles, and why he listens to melancholic music. Environment and smell is as important to him as music. And we talk about how difficult it is to overcome grief and the strategies we develop for giving us strength. And at the end of the interview, we learn what Jeremy's childhood self would think about what he is doing now, and how life is about holding challenging and wonderful experiences together. So what a huge privilege this week to interview Jeremy Caret. My name is Chris Deasy. Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Well, it is my absolute pleasure to have Jeremy Caret here. And we were just talking, Jeremy, that it's exactly 15 years since we both started working. Actually, it was quite surreal because we both got the job, or a job, on the same day. So we both sort of started working as contemporaries.
Yeah, it feels a long time ago. And a lot of changes at Kent and in the department too.
Yeah. And it was really funny because when we started, I was very aware that there were some people who'd started working at the university in the 1960s when it started. I mean, literally, they might have been like 20 when they started. They were now approaching 70. And it was very strange because to be working somewhere where you realise that people have given their whole life to one particular sort of place of work. But then we've both been here for 15 years and, you know, have no intention of going elsewhere. So I can see the appeal of that, the sort of long-term investment in a place.
Yeah, and I think the strange thing for me is coming here because of love and trying to be near to Paris. And I was in Scotland, as you know, and then I remember very vividly that day, and Robin Gill making it clear that if I was to come here, I would have to demote myself from the previous, because I'd previously been head of department at Stirling and was, I think, a senior lecturer there. And he made it very clear that we wouldn't appoint me at the same level the challenges of that. But because I wanted to be in reach of Paris to be with my now wife, then that was the pull of Kent. Ironically, you know, here we are in the world of Brexit, but the power of Kent was because of its European connectedness.
So it was love. It's like that film with Ethan Hawke, you know, sort of, you know, in proximity to Paris. It's obviously that there's obviously a very particular nexus here that you're in sight of. And, you know, obviously love was what brought you here, but obviously on lots of levels, intellectually, academically, professionally, it's worked out really well.
Yes, I think it's always amazing when certain things come together. And of course, the extraordinary thing of coming to Canterbury is the link to the Huguenots and the Huguenot chapel underneath the cathedral. And my name is Caret, which is a Huguenot name. And I hadn't been aware so much of how powerful the Huguenot links are to the region of Kent. And in terms of the acceptance of the Huguenots when they arrived in late 17th century, now we have the museum up in Medway for the Huguenots. And as you know, when we married, having a French wife and whose father was uniquely from Alsace, which is the only Protestant area of France, that we were able to have this, in addition to a Quaker ceremony, we were able to have a blessing and a service in French in the Huguenot chapel underneath the cathedral, which is great for the wedding photographs because they're all outside the cathedral and it looks really wonderful with the trees there. But the Huguenot chapel, I think, is a great connection to the past and a connection to France. And as you know, they have services there at 3 o'clock every Sunday in French. So that was a lovely sense of history coming together. And, of course, in the period of time we've been here, the rail services have also amazingly improved. And that's transformed links both to Paris and the continent as well as to London.
No, because I was very conscious when we started here that it would take as long to get to London from Canterbury as it did from Cardiff to London. And, you know, Cardiff, there may have been fewer stops and it was a faster service, but it would take about an hour and 55 minutes. And then I was a bit disappointed because when I moved to Canterbury, I thought, oh, I'll go to London, maybe see a few films or do a thing. And it was like, you know, yeah, it was best part of 2 hours, really, to get to London. Of course, the train would stop everywhere. But after about 5 years, suddenly, this new route was introduced, and of course very handy from a Paris point of view as well, because you'd have the fast service but from London to Canterbury, as well as obviously from Ashford to Paris. So for you, it sort of couldn't have come at a better time.
Yeah, I mean, 15 years ago, though, the service from Paris was much better. I mean, we've seen the services reduced now to about 2 or 3 a day. And I think that was the challenge. I'm grateful now that I don't have to do that route regularly for a weekly commute sort of thing. Yeah. But the technical links are more difficult. We obviously can go up to London and have Ebbsfleet. But the Eurostar has been wonderful. I love it as a train. I've written many things on it, and as you know, I met Jarvis Cocker.
I didn't know that.
And that was a kind of it was for me a sense that the whole of life is passing through the Eurostar, and because he had a French partner and a child. And so regularly made that travel. And we talked about William James, which was what I was working on at the time. And we talked about life in the transitions as we were both commuting on that journey.
But I like the idea that you were on a train and you were doing some writing and then you see Jarvis Cocker. So, of course, you must have been doing some Pulp Fiction. but I think you recognised him, or did he recognise you? I mean, how did that conversation happen?
Well, I mean, it surprised me that it was in a regular seat. It wasn't in, business class that he was sitting. And then I just slowly started to realise that the person next to me was Jarvis Cocker. Yeah. So I think at some point, maybe it's one of those moments when the train stops for a while or something, and then you have a moment of conversation, and then... and then we just exchanged the sense of. I think he was constructing some music, and on some technical machinery and music. And I think there was a sort of shared understanding of our lives involved this commuting route, and we talked about the challenges of that.
Yeah, because I had a colleague when I was at Lampeter, actually, who used to, he was a big football fan, and he supported a team that was like the other side of London, you know, from Lampeter. But what he would do, he'd leave very early in the morning and get the train from, I think, like Port Talbot to London, and then get another train up from London. But he said that he got all his article writing done. So on a Saturday, because he was travelling for so long, so he'd have a very productive sort of intellectual day working on his articles, but then the football, and then go back of an evening. So kind of being able to wear lots of hats. And I think that's interesting, because if you're travelling by train, as long as you're in the right sort of environment and you're comfortable around other people, or you've, you know, you can guarantee a seat and you're able to focus, it can be a really productive sort of quite liminal sort of space as well as you're driving. And I have found that sometimes you can be more productive because you're up against the clock as well. You're like, well, I've got half an hour, so either or nothing, or I write everything that I can.
Yeah, I think it was a very productive time for me, but not really just because of the Eurostar, but because I would be only going back at weekends, and I would live in the little flat that we had here at the time, and had a kind of week free of any family duties, so to speak, to where I was just writing and working. And I remember that even though my sort of emotional life was in Paris, that I was in the department more than colleagues who lived round the corner, because I didn't have anywhere only family reason to go home, and so I think it was that was as much the reason for the kind of writing at that period of time, and also shaping the department. But I think it was an exciting time, and we had created a new era for religious studies at Kent, and we drew attention to what the department could be. I think it had frozen with a kind of very small group of staff, and there were tensions and divisions in that department when we arrived.
And I did kind of feel that what was really strange is that, having come from another institution, and just suggesting, even like at, you know, boards of study, about some of the things that I thought might be a solution, which was sort of based on, this is what I just did day to day in my previous job. But because I was in a new place, people thought, that sounds like a really good idea, or why didn't you do that? And I was thinking, gosh, you know, it's not, you know, they may not even have been my ideas, in the sense they were just sort of things that I'd been, you know, handed, you know, tasked to do in my previous employment. So I think sometimes having a new broom, effectively, you know, and because we both arrived at the same time, I think it probably did mean that the department was both grew in terms of numbers, but also in terms of the range and diversity of what we were able to offer. And I think that the students at the time, you know, were very clearly of a view that, you know, what we were doing, you know, was welcomed. So that was really gratifying. It's a gamble, of course, when you start anywhere.
Yeah, we brought a greater capacity to the department, and I think that was good for the department. Yeah. And I think we broke up some of the old habits. And I think the key thing for me was just to appreciating the range of people in the department. I mean, I always knew Kent as being a real research centre for religious experience and the mystical engagements, and also because of the Ramsay Chair, and which Robin Gill has obviously been a big influence on both our careers in bringing us here. But I think reconciling those two sides of the department and trying not to get involved in the complexities of that relationship, and then certainly when I became head of department, the key thing for me was to ensure that we built on the base that you and I had constructed, and took it through all that transition. I think you and I were at one point holding the entire department. There were three of us.
There was one point, yes, when a few colleagues had retired, and you're right, there was a transitional period, yeah.
So from, you know, this department had been big, and then some of the old guard had moved on, sometimes uneasily and sometimes by want. But I think we had to keep it going when we were down to three, and then we got the investments which we've been fighting for, and that was where I think the big change and renewing the Ramsey chair. I remember the conversation with Julia Goodfellow very, very clearly. And we had those saying that how she valued the research of the Ramsey chair. Yeah. And the question was the links that were changing with the theological college at that time. But that moved nationally anyway, because they decided to centralise the training. So the department took a different focus.
It did, yes, because when we started, you're absolutely right. There was, I think the reason we were both appointed at the same time was because we were doing a lot of sort of teaching people who wanted to be priests, and that was hardly our core job, but it did also sort of justify the appointment. But then when the department grew, then obviously that wasn't something that we were so sort of embedded in that, you know, that if anything, you know, it gave us freed us up to cultivate other research and teaching pursuits.
It reminds me of the kind of crazy days then, because you're right, we were doing two jobs, servicing the Theological College, which was in London and in Medway, and at the then doing the teaching here. And I remember on the Monday morning that I would get up at 5 o'clock in the suburbs of where, leafy suburbs of outer Paris, and get the commuter train in at 5 o'clock in the morning in order to get here for my teaching around about 9 or 10 o'clock, and then we do the day of teaching here, and then I had to get onto the train to go to London and do the teaching up in London in the evening, so that was a very full time.
It felt like sometimes a form of like moonlighting, so I did kind of feel, because they were very different hats, but I learned something in that period, which is, you know, what my comfort zone is, because I'd always find that when I was teaching the undergraduates here, particularly the second and third years who'd chosen to do modules that I was teaching, I felt that they were very receptive, and I felt that I bonded with them, and I felt that my teaching improved. But I do the teaching that you refer to of an evening, and they were, I mean, I was in my early 30s at the time, and I was easily half the age of most of the people there. And I'd be talking about some of my work on film, which I sort of got the sense that the students here were always keen to hear about. And I remember once, you know, somebody said, "I'm sorry, this is blasphemy." and it was very hard to recover from that, because it was just, I think they were just two very different teaching environments. And I think that whereas students here might have been very keen to choose particular modules that I was delivering, there it was much more the case that I was providing something from a very different sort of vantage point. You know, they were training to be priests, and I didn't have a clerical background. And I think in that, they were some of the very professional people, and I think, but something didn't connect. And I learned from that, and it took a few knocks, because I couldn't work out why I didn't seem to be able to control a class. But then I'd, you know, come back here, and I'd think, oh, I'm fine, you know. So there's something about Tuesday didn't work, but Wednesday is working. So somehow I thought that, you know, all I've got to do is make sure that, you know, I pick out what's good on the Wednesday and see what, you know, and make sure then that defines me more than the Tuesday. And it took me a while, but I think that on balance, I sort of got to where I needed to be.
Between sort of teaching 18 to 21 year olds and then teaching mature students, and that was the difference. But we've gone through a lot of transitions in that time, and I think that searching out Gordon and for the Ramsey chair. And it was good that the Archbishop took an interest in the renewal of that chair.
Yeah, he was on the appointment panel, wasn't he, Rowan Williams?
And he was very committed to the academic life as well, obviously. Yeah. And then I think that, the changes went on. I think with the last REF 2014, when we appointed the Glasgow Three, that expanded the department. We went from 24th to 7th in the research scale, and I think that put the department in a different position for the future. Obviously, we now move into different phases and different challenges, and I'm now not so much in the department as being Dean for Europe.
It's true, because we used to see a lot more of you, but of course you're, and it's ironic because when you started here, you were living in Paris and obviously, you know, commuting here, but now you're based in Canterbury, but of course, as Dean for Europe, you go the opposite, so I don't know whether that was your intentional plan or whether it's sort of one of life's, you know, there's a Woody Allen, I'm sure there's like a Woody Allen film here somewhere about, you know, you've like passed yourself on routes, you know, 15 years ago, if you were doing now what you're doing now 15 years ago, you'd have been in a perfect place.
Yeah, many people have pointed out that irony. Yeah. It's really about opportunities. When I had the opportunity to be head of department again, that's sort of a natural space, and I was there for a few years, and then I think I came in for 8 years. And then the head of school role came, and I think it was just the things that I was dealing with as the head of SECL were so related to some things going on in Europe anyway, because SECL has the investments in Rome and Athens and in Paris. So I already got a sense of, and I think it was just timing. I think a lot of life is about seizing opportunities when they arise, and sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. But when they do, you know, you have to make that commitment. And I remember thinking that, yes, this would involve travel the other way, and that would be challenging, but it was just a great opportunity, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, I think it's a great role, and the whole position that I have on life is about building relationships. Relationality is how I conceive of life, as William James's whole philosophy is a relational philosophy that just as chemicals like HTO, water is a combination of chemicals from the very beginnings of the universe, being different combinations. Life happens because of the kinds of combinations of things that we can have, and I follow that Jamesian understanding, which is also in my other great dialogical partner Foucault, is also about the knowledge as relationship. So to be able to have that intellectual position and then to have a role which is about relationship building and how those relationships and experiences across culture can enhance learning and can provide a richness to sets of programs. I think that for me it's been great. And of course, the thing I didn't anticipate within all of that is that during the time that I was Dean for Europe, that this thing called Brexit would come in. So strangely, unbeknown to me at the time, I would be being drawn into the whirlwind of one of the biggest changes of British society and higher education, as yet still unconcluded. But a lot of my time has been in the last year particularly has been taken up with trying to deal and plan for much of the Brexit challenges.
And in that sense, it must feel like being right in the midst of a hurricane or a whirlwind. In fact, one of my previous guests, who's American, an American lawyer, was saying that, you know, he was in America at the time when Donald Trump was elected, but then coming here. But he said, you know, he wouldn't have it otherwise. It's sort of like there's something here. We may not know what the outcome's going to be. We don't know how it happens. But being at the heart of this or witnessing this, you know, we will look back in 5 or 10 years' time and, you know, sort of try and say, you know, what was going on? What was ordinary life like? One of my other guests, in fact, was talking about who's a specialist in First World War drama, and, you know, were the theatres open during the war? Well, the answer was yes, but, you know, these days, you know, Brexit's going on, but, you know, I go to the cinema of an evening, and, you know, the university is still here. But I think in years to come, there'll be a lot of, you know, myth-making going on, and I think people will sort of, you know, how do we manage during this period of utter turbulence? People didn't know, you know, whether their businesses would collapse. People didn't know what was around the corner. And I think that, I mean, I've always been a diarist, but, you know, being at the heart, I mean, you more than me, because obviously you're the Dean for Europe, and going around all these European centres and having to be very, I guess, be a diplomat in many respects for you know, not knowing what might happen, but also knowing that, you know, you have to be very strategic and very professional and hopefully weather the storm that's already happening.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think you have to kind of keep the vision that knowledge is better for collaboration. And that often people don't see the immediacy of that. And yet we have to try to make it very concrete that the great advances in knowledge have been about partnerships. We don't discover things in isolation. We discover things in dialogue. And a good example of that is this big project that we've established with the University of Lille. And, of course, they have the Institut Pasteur there. And that is, of course, one of the centres for the BCG vaccination. And you know, we need those medical collaborations. And we need to be enriched by cultural exchanges, whether it's across literature or political and social understanding. And we can't get away, I think, from the fact that European culture has some common elements, and that the very structure of our law, of our higher education institutions, of our thinking in terms of democracy, all of these come from the Greco-Roman traditions, and of course the way that Europe incorporated other different traditions through the globalization, different kinds of forces that are drawn into the construction of Europe today, which is certainly a multicultural Europe, and those are increasing the celebration of diversity, I think, is always important. For reminding people that we survive together. And the difficulty for me as in the role as Dean for Europe is trying to get people to separate out the notion of Europe from European Union. And as a university, it's not always easy to kind of keep a clear messaging that we're not political institution, we're an academic institution, but we get involved in political processes. The Universities UK is absolutely clear that universities flourish through their connections with European institutions, and the message has always been a very strong one that we need to keep the partnerships, keep within Erasmus, keep within Horizon, and that's, I think that's right. But the message we have to take forward, if we are facing Brexit, is that we need to ensure that the value of being connected to Europe is an essential part of for our knowledge and for our economy and who we are as a people and as a species, because connectedness is always going to be important for whatever developments in the future. So that even if we come out of a political institution, we still remain connected to countries and cultures and knowledge exchanges that are beneficial to us all.
Yeah, and I find that very much here, that there is, particularly on the campus where there are so many members of staff as well as students from Europe and further afield, a real sense here that what we have in common is far greater than that which divides us. In fact, you know, when I used to take my children to the nursery of a morning, you know, I'd say half the other parents there were from Spain or from France or from Germany, and we'd have some wonderful conversations in the morning. And I think kind of there was, and Brexit was happening, in fact, literally, I remember going in the morning after the Brexit result and David Cameron had just resigned, and just talking to some of the other parents at the nursery. But there was this sense of resilience, like, this isn't what we were expecting, it may not be what we wanted, but actually, you know, we have some wonderful friends and colleagues, and that's worth fighting for. So whatever happens, you know, we mustn't lose sight of the wider sense of priority. And I think that it has actually brought a lot of people together. It's been a very fractional and fractious period, but also I think it's also made people ask themselves, what do you want? Do you know, inclusivity and diversity and equality. I think these are sort of, and at the time I was the EDI officer for SECL, I was sort of very aware of how these things transcended whatever might be going on politically, which of course we have perhaps far less control over. There are some things, and as Dean for Europe, you can set an agenda, and you can, you know, sort of in that sense say, well, you know, given the resources we have, let us see where we go. And I think people are very responsive to that.
Well, I think the key thing is that whatever happens, we are determined to build on our relationships in Europe and recognise that these partnerships are vital to students, to knowledge, and to ultimately the economy. So I think it's going to be a challenge if we face a no deal. And I think that what I've been trying to do with my colleagues here is to ensure that we're in the best possible place for any uncertainty. But we live with the uncertainty at the moment. I think the uncertainty, as many people have said, is the greatest problem.
Going back a little bit though, I mean, I suppose it's funny that, you know, from that point of saying we're facing very challenging times, and because obviously nostalgia is the theme that runs through this series of interviews, how do you feel sort of looking back? Is there a sense of childhood being a kind of better place, a sort of more innocent period, or is there something more bittersweet about how you remember, conceptualize the past? I don't know how far back you can go, you're able to go. I don't know what you remember from childhood, what your earliest memories are, but is there something about the past that kind of does appeal?
Well, I think that the first thing to say in relationship to all of this is that I'm deeply influenced by psychoanalysis. Yeah. And I have spent many years thinking through the works of Freud and the works of Jung, and the psychological methodology has always been one that has been shaped from my family. And my father, who was obviously a canon of the Church of England, and he was principally a therapist. He followed the work of Carl Rogers, client-centered therapy, and basically he dealt with all of the difficulties that were in the church, the things that the bishops didn't like to deal with, the broken marriages, the complex sexualities, the people who were rejected, the marginalised. So I had access to a library which was a combination of books on psychological theories and theological theories from a very early age, and very interested in the work of R.D. Lang, the anti-psychiatrist. In fact, I went to the Isle of Iona on a workshop with R.D. Lang, and which was an unforgettable experience, because obviously he's challenging the boundaries of past and present in lots of different ways. So that's a very convoluted way of saying that I think about the past with a fundamental frame of the present emotion, that there are things that happen in our past which determine our present. And I engage with those things in the past with an attempt to understand that emotional drive that shaped me in my early days and how it forms me now. And I think probably we've shared this in our conversations, but I wanted to train to be a psychoanalyst. Part of my... Before I did my doctorate, I had done an MPhil in the psychology of religion with Adrian Cunningham at Lancaster. And at that point, I thought that I would go to London to train. And in order to train, you had to have some clinical practice. And so I went to work in a school for children with autism. During this time, you also had to have training. So I did a training analysis. And I went through my past a lot. I'm of the belief that this desire to have analysis and to be a professional was a cover for the real desire to try and actually deal with the death of my parents. Both my parents died just when they were 50 and 58, and they were big moments, because I was just finishing my master's at that point. And there were many things that I had to work through. So I think that I don't just think about the past in terms of my past, but about generational pasts as well because of that. So I'm as much interested in, and as my father was, and the impact of his parents. And of course, one of the Jungian trends is also to think about one's collective past. And I've always been fascinated in the inheritance as a Huguenot, somebody my generations of my family that had to kind of move from France to Southern Ireland. And most of my family lived in Ireland for 200 years before they went to Yorkshire. On my father's side, that is. But I think the past needs to be engaged with a kind of critical reflexivity.
Yeah.
That often we can't get to the past as it is, but we layer it with all sorts of other emotions through the subsequent years. And that how I felt about my past when I was 16, or my early childhood when I was 16, and my early childhood when I was 20 or 30, or even now, is actually constantly being modified. So I have a different sense of nostalgia. Is I remember those times with warmth, not that I think that any past time is any better than any other point. You may pick out different moments of delight from your past and try and forget the difficult bits. But for me, my experience is that life always got better. That I didn't enjoy being a teenager.
Yeah.
And I moved around a lot because my father went to different parishes. So maybe that I didn't have the solidity of a place, although I always was in the north of England, which has a sense of place. So I don't over-romanticise the past. And I do think that we can, in that psychoanalytical sense, delude ourselves about the past. But I do believe it's fundamental to try and have a narrative or a story about one's past in order to then move on from it.
Yeah, and I've discovered even since starting this interview series, probably, and certainly doing the work on nostalgia, that my understanding or engagement with the past has changed quite fundamentally. I mean, there were particular people who, I wasn't sure if it was the idea of certain people or the people themselves from 25, 30 years ago, for example, when I was a student, that during particularly difficult periods in my life, in my marriage, I'd sometimes look back and think, okay, there was a time when sitting in their living rooms, their kitchens, their bedrooms, going down the student union bar, coffee shops, having conversations. Why am I having those conversations now? So there was a part of me that thought I could almost, you know, looking back at old pictures, old diary writings, I think there's a thread here, that there's something here that makes me really want to reach out. And through social media, of course, there are pros and cons in all of this. People are a little bit too accessible sometimes. But what I discovered is that in many cases, they were in my head, because I've met up with a lot of the people and I'm so glad I've done so. But you realise that in many respects, if friendships didn't go the way you might have hoped they, you know, in subsequent years, you look back and think, oh, why didn't that develop this way or that way? Maybe there was a reason for it. And you realise that very quickly, you see that people don't change that fundamentally, in the sense that people often have the same sort of attitude, the same sort of predilections, the same sort of way of dealing with issues, maybe the same sort of, you know, the sort of, I found this with a lot of people who'll say, yeah, I you know, I'll definitely be there next Thursday, or I'll see you at the reunion, and so on, and they don't turn up. And you suddenly think, hang on a minute, this is just like a replaying of what happened 25 years ago, but you forget all those negative bits. So my grasp of the past has changed. It's very important, but also, rather than perhaps looking for somebody else to bail me out psychologically or indeed in actuality, I do kind of feel that along the way there are people who are still very much part of me, and sometimes they're there virtually or digitally, in some cases geographically they're present, because I've met up with many people from that period of my life. But also I realise that at the end of the day I have a lot more autonomy in this than I ever realised, and that rather than being at the whim and the mercy of what other people are offering, I can say, hang on a minute, what is the right thing for me? And then when you look at it through that sort of lens, a lot of other things will just fall into place. And I found that rather than wait for somebody else to almost sort of say, okay, this is the answer, I'll whisk you away, I'll do this, I'll do that. Sometimes you say, okay, what do I want? What's going to make me happy? What's going to make me tick? And then suddenly that sort of realignment or recalibration, I think, can lead to a really sort of positive future. So for the first time, rather than think my golden days were 25 or 30 years ago, I can think, wow, you know, why can't tomorrow? Why can't today? Why can't tomorrow be a golden age? And so suddenly, something has clicked.
See, I mean, I found that very interesting because you're supposed to be interviewing me, but one of the things I would say to you is, why do you focus on nostalgia? Yeah. What are the reasons for you finding this useful to think through? And I would say what your answer there is very indicative of. Your need to wrestle with nostalgia is about some of your own psychological baggage, if you like.
Yeah, and I'm very transparent about that in different guises, in terms of, you know, the different. When people say to me, "Why are you doing this podcast series?" You know, there are actually at least a dozen answers, and I might just give one or two of them in the, you know, but in each conversation, a different one will emerge. But I think you're right. But also, being a diarist, it is. It also means that I have a sense of context or perspective when it comes to the past, and that's something I'd be interested to hear what your take on this is that I found that, you know, sometimes I have a diary entry that gives me a better sense of proportion and perspective than I otherwise would have, because I might, you know, be overly dramatizing or imagining particular episodes as being hugely momentous, but actually looking at the diary entry from the time, and it's perhaps the subsequent, you know, what emerged subsequently that has made me put that particular person or that particular event on a pedestal. And I think that in a way it's always a corrective. And so I have a very sort of critical understanding of the past because I've got the actual records from the time mixed with those memories and conversations. So it's a constant engagement. And I will often go back and annotate the past and with in italics, they go back over those old diary entries and perhaps write embellish some of those points so that you know, in 20 years' time, people will look back and perhaps, or I'll look back and have a much more nuanced, hopefully, sense rather than the whole sort of, better then.
Because I think what's important about that is that we fabricate the past through the contemporary emotional perspective. The key thing is to get through the illusion and then to the real. Because I think it's not that certain things don't happen. It's that we need to recognize why we can recall certain things and why we can't recall others. I think that it's not so much nostalgia that's interesting to me as memory, the nature of memory, and what I decide to foreground and what I decide to... sometimes just out of sheer necessity, because I think forgetting is as much an important task in clearing the mind and moving forward, particularly for traumas, as in remembering. It's a complex. But the past does determine our present. That's the key thing, and therefore we have to negotiate our memory and our past in different ways. But I think not to over romanticize it. Every period of our life is full of joys and struggles, and that we pick out sometimes in the memory the good bits if we're being nostalgic. And we forget, actually, that was a pretty tough time.
The danger, I think, is taking something out of context, because I can look back to my undergraduate days and think, this was great, because I met so many wonderful people from so many different parts of the world, and it just felt so energizing. And yet, I was unbelievably stressed and busy because I had deadlines all the time. In those days, unlike students today, we'd have to write essays, but they weren't assessed. It was more that they were literally coursework essays rather than assessed essays. And so it was sort of like, well, this will help you with your exam at the end of your final year. So, you know, whether you, in some cases, students may not have bothered too much because they knew that it didn't count towards their degree. But what's interesting in that period is that I'm looking back on a period when I was very happy and exuberant and the structured by life. There were so many things going on at the same time. But it was also a time when nobody quite knew what the future had in store. Nobody knew what sort of jobs we'd have. Nobody, you know, and even short term, we'd worry about, you know, is that essay good enough? And will we get the degree classification that we hope for? So it would be very dangerous to try and think, oh, you know, I used to enjoy playing pool, or I used to enjoy, you know, putting the jukebox on at the student union, or going on long walks to the Falkendale Lake or whatever it might be, because that's all great. But also what was going on around that? And for me, a diary is a good corrective against overly either sentimentalizing or in some cases also disparaging the past, because it's easy to say, you know, well, I thought it was nice at the time, but after what happened 5 years later and that person turned out not to be who I thought they were, that sort of thing. So I think that having a sense of perspective is deeply important. But what I was going to ask you, though, is whether there were other things going on, I mean, musically or films. I know, obviously, this is, you know, we have a shared Woody Allen passion, but was there anything particularly from growing up or even university days where you can say, this was going on in the background and it stayed with you? I mean, the charts for me were like, I was just obsessed with those and kind of still am to an extent, because that's an important part of, you know, the wider tapestry of what was going on in my life.
Yeah, I mean, just to some extent, engaged with some of that, but it was much more peripheral. The key memories of my life are obviously driven by the fact that I'm the son of a clergyman, and my life is within a church. My father was not the traditional clergyman. He was known as one of the radical priests of the 1960s, you know, questioning things like the virgin birth and things like that. And he brought a new wave to that. But interestingly enough, he was very much a musician, and he not only played the organ, but he played the piano at home. And he played jazz, and so my earliest memories are this combination, if you like, of choral music and wild jazz. And jazz became to represent something of the letting go. And I shared a little bit that, which my father. I mean, I just for parties and for my earliest memories. You know, we play musical statues, as you do for joint parties.
I know, yeah.
and the music that he would choose would be some jazz improvisation on the piano, and then he would stop playing, you know, and we'd all freeze. So an interest in jazz, and in later life, I wasn't into jazz myself specifically as a child, but in later life I went along to some concerts with him. And On the other side, that my parents were of the Beatles generation, sort of bringing up children in the mid '60s, and so on my mother's side, I remember my earliest memories is on a holiday and dancing to Bill Haley and
Rock Around the Clock.
The Clock. And I've always retained since that, as my wife will tell you, I'm not a good dancer, but I can do rock and roll. And I think it's from this sort of early association of my mother and Bill Haley. So that those are the kind of very earliest sort of things around me. And the Beatles remains one of the greatest sort of parts of my musical life to this day, because I always had this sort of like of John Lennon, particularly because of his trying to break convention. Mm. But when we all go on holiday as a family, the music that we would well, it's a combination of French popular music as well. But everybody likes the Beatles, and I like the long standingness of that. So you can like reintroducing it. Mm. And the other sort of music. I suppose when I was 11, I remember going to see a film of ABBA's. I think it was their Australian tour.
Oh, yeah, for like 1977, that sort of period.
Sort of period. And I remember one of my first albums was Arrival, some early, and with Thank You for the Music. Yeah. Now, as my family will tell you, I have a sort of contrast, even like sort of lively dancing around music of the rock and roll. I think I remember an early album I bought at that time of 77, 78, the Steve Gibbons Band, which is kind of an edgy rock and roll bit. But I generally listen to sad music, to say. There's some melancholy in me, which I am always trying to make sense of. But I was almost a bit reclusive as well, so I didn't fully engage or absorbing in the charts, although my brother did. Little bits, and I think probably, as I said, I wouldn't say I was into music a lot. Mm. If you're thinking about the past for me, it would be that I remember place much more and seasons. So because we moved around a lot, I can remember places on the Yorkshire Dales and a little fishing village called Staithes, places around Cheshire, where my mother's family were living, the smells of each of the seasons. Some of my deepest memories would be early morning, walking to a church and feeling the seasons. So the natural world and memory is much more ingrained in me. The sea, particularly, being by the sea. Mm. So this is interesting, a sense of environment and smell is as much important to me as music. But I think that I do remember my university years a little bit more through music than my earlier years. And largely that was around the work of Joni Mitchell and some of through my brother who was very into Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, that kind of music. So, but I was very much also into specific singer songwriters like Joni Mitchell. I mean, and maybe my obsession with an academic obsession, I would get everything of one artist. Mm. So I get everything of Joni Mitchell. And then I was very much into Cat Stevens. And I got everything that Cat Stevens has. Yeah.
Well, it showed that you obviously had a penchant for looking at life from both sides now. but it, actually, yeah. I did also say that same joke to Andrew Hass, who gave the same answer. But, it's funny what you say about the Beatles, actually, because I saw Yesterday for the second time yesterday, which is the sort of thing, you know, if in an alternate reality the Beatles didn't exist, effectively we'd have to invent them. And then added to that, what would happen if John Lennon, you know, because if the Beatles didn't exist, then John Lennon wouldn't have been shot. But, you know, and the philosophical implications of that are huge, but also shows how people that we've never met, although I'm fascinated that you met Jarvis Cocker, but the people that we haven't met can have this hold over us, and I can be sitting in a car on a bus, I can just be listening to or just think about something from 30, 40, 50 years ago, maybe before I was even born, and it suddenly is so evocative of something in my life, but it's sort of like almost taking that stranger, you know, that outsider, that external force, which is such a powerful conduit for evoking, for good and ill, all sorts of memories and sentiments.
Yeah, though I've always been critical of the cult of celebrity, largely because I think everybody is fundamentally human and vulnerable, and the masks of the celebrity status. I do think it's nice you share an historical period with people, and that you go through moments. And I think this is more in terms of watching political figures on the television. And when you look back, you say, I live through this. When I was a teenager, I was very much into Tony Benn, another diarist that you would appreciate. And I liked him because of that ability to understand history and being in history. And I think that any time that we're in, we have to think critically about it and give it perspective. now, interestingly enough, I've gone through a set of thoughts in relation to bigger scoping of history, largely related to the experience introduced to me by my wife of going to the caves in the Dordogne region and seeing the cave paintings. I think it was one of the most profound changing moments of my life, actually, was seeing pictures of drawn on the caves of 30,000 years ago. And then you get perspective that it's not just about the historical time, but evolutionary time. And I think all of these things are really crucial in terms of the present climate change situation, because these are the bigger scale of what we are as a species and what we go through. And I kind of like that time frame. I'm always trying to kind of find a different perspective. It's about, I think that's what relationship thinking or relational thinking is about.
Yeah, and I mean, just a few more philosophically based questions to round off. But I mean, is it possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences? I think, I mean, you kind of answered that, but I mean, this is the big question for me about whether our memories are predominantly positive ones, and if they're not, what do we do with them? Because I mentioned the undergraduate experience for me. Then it was a case of, okay, seize the opportunity. There's a lot going on in a very concentrated period, but there were skills which I didn't know that I had, which to this day, I think that's what I remember most. It's not the people necessarily from that period. It's, I mean, they were very much important in terms of cultivating my own sense of value or giving me a sense of perspective. But what I find really important about that period is it was a case of saying, okay, there are all these challenges. I need to be structured. I need to be disciplined. I need to make sure I do A, B, C. But also, crucially, come the evening, I can go and meet up with those friends. I'm not going to let them down. I hope they don't let me down. And go and, you know, just chew the cud. And in a place like Lampeter, which was very small and, you know, there were lots of opportunities, you'd always see the same people all the time, but being able to sort of really cherish those evenings and sort of knowing that they may not last forever, that we will all have to move on at some point. And I think there's a wistfulness in my account of what happened, which is also important. If, you know, it was what I did with the opportunities and the challenges that were there, rather than in some sort of isolation or a form of, you know, I have a problem with binaries, as you know, sort of then saying, you know, either, yes, this was a positive memory, this was a negative memory. The two are utterly juxtaposed and conjoined, but it's what I did and what I learned from that, and whether that still has value now, that I think is important.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very fascinating question. And I think there are different ways of looking at it. I think very painful moments, we can get locked into them in some ways. And I think it's important to recognize that your painful moments in life form you as much as the positive ones. Mm. Obviously in ways that you don't necessarily want. But I always remember the poetry of Khalil Gibran, and he said, "Your pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses you. You will become something else through the pain." And I just think it's a part of that critical reflexivity that when you're looking back at a particular moment in your life, it's important not to overplay it. Over-sensationalize it, but to recognize it, what it is, and to constantly revisit it with different kinds of narrative from the strength of your present position, because you are the great thing. If you come through those bits of suffering, as I think I mentioned, the death of my parents was a very distinct one, there you gain something in a kind of way which enables you to see life because of the difficulty in a way that you couldn't see it before. And part of the healing is to recognize what you can get through that. But I don't think I'm nostalgic for those moments, because I think the strange thing about grief is that in some ways you never overcome the loss. But you find different ways of managing it. You find different strategies to manage it. And as you grow and develop, you build on the good things that have happened after those events to give you the strength. But that doesn't mean to say, I mean, I was with my father. I mean, he was a conversational partner. I mean, we reflected on life together. And I always wish that I could continue having these conversations or bits of these conversations. And certainly my first books were conversations to my father in that way. So, yeah, I think that, trying to come back to your question, we do look at those moments. And I'll give you one example, really. I remember after the death of my mother, that the four children that we were in those big hearse cars, we the four of us sitting in it, and we held each other's hands to try to deal with this particular day that we of grief. And in one sense, that you can look back at a moment like that and say, you know, that was an incredible moment of holding and belief that we could get through this together and get through the day together. So I think that's a recollection of sort, but I'm not nostalgic for that. I don't want to go back to that moment. No. I think I want to say, yes, yeah, some of that connected strength got us through that day, and that was a strong moment. But now we're in the present, and actually life's evolved a lot in many different ways.
But just a final thought: what do you think your 5-year-old or your 15-year-old self would make of what you're doing now? If your 5 or 15-year-old self had a glimpse of what you're doing now, where you are, what would that child in you think? Have you fulfilled the dreams, really, of whatever those dreams were when you were young?
Well, they were different kind of dreams, that's the funny thing. But yeah, I think ultimately delighted and surprised, I think, would be the some of my most depressing moments actually were at dealing with the lonely life at university in my first years. And I remember at Manchester University there was a place in the cafe where I would look out and from the Student Union building at this cafe and look at the life on the Oxford Road to Manchester. And I often go back and have a conversation with that particular person because of the particular uncertainty of his life and say, look, that's what life can change in wonderful ways, you'll make great achievements, and you know, I think completing this book and meeting my wife and these great the moments that you have, and when you're searching for your identity, when you're struggling for who you are at university, and you wonder what you'll be. I don't know what my job will be, what my future will be, and you're grappling with all of that existential angst. It's great to feel you come through those things. Of course, at that particular moment, I didn't even have my father was still alive. So it's not so much just the achievements you get these great moments of achievement in terms of becoming Dean for Europe or whatever it may be, but you also have come through a lot of things as well. So life is about holding both challenging experiences and wonderful experiences together. Life is a mixture of those, and one will constantly seek to survive and make sense of things. So that's And now I think, because I think it is the most important thing of our time, is that the challenge of our own species surviving with the climate change. I think that we all, and Brexit itself, we all have these immense challenges, and there will be good, and then there will be difficult times because of those. But I believe in people and I believe in relationships to help us overcome things.
Jeremy, this has been such a poignant and reflective conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's good to reconnect with you.